This is Blueprint for Living, the last half hour. I'm Jonathan Green, and this week, Christmas. I will honour Christmas in my heart and try and keep it all the year. Charles Dickens. Richard Cornish is a food writer. Richard, Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you.
And it's a time for coming together. It's a time for eating and feasting. And yet it's more than that.
It's a time for gossip and grooming. It's a time for sitting down. And the reason why we have that plenty, where we have those big plates of food, we all sit down afterwards and we recount the stories of Christmases gone past. It's really like the ring giving from Beowulf. We've had this great big saga of a year and we come together to tell our stories, to tell, you know, to pass on the stories of ourselves as younger people to our older aunts and uncles and grandparents, and then to hear their stories as well. And it's done in such a safe and convivial environment, aided with a lot of meat and sweet things and alcohol, that the story just flows on. And
you must have a high-functioning family, because I think a lot of people out there say, whoa. We're all pretty sick of each other by about 4 p.m.
And that's the idyllic version of it, of course.
Yes. Which takes us to the food, and you and I have had this conversation before.
Oh, many times.
That I am a very much in the ham and turkey camp with Christmas. For me, Christmas is a particular thing. It's a sequence of events, and it's a sequence of dishes, and that must not be tampered with. You, however, are of an alternative opinion.
I like the idea of the feast. I like the idea of sitting down and doing nothing for a long period of time. And I love the fact that dotted around the countryside along our coast are huge middens of oysters all the way around the Australian coast. And that's where, for thousands of years, the Indigenous people have got the right idea. They sit and feast and they talk. They collect the oysters and the mussels. And I just talk and talk and talk and talk. And I reckon...
The occasional hoik of a shell over
the
shoulder.
The hoik of the shell over the shell. And you'll put them in the fire. Why not? Snap them open and over the coals. And that's where we've got it right in Australia. I think it's one of the few things we've done to actually engage with our environment is at Christmas time, we eat the bounty of the sea. Like, for the rest of the year, we might... eat food from, you know, from around the country, wheat from central New South Wales, beef from Victoria. We'll get tropical fruit from Queensland. But the one time of the year we head locally is Christmas time when we can eat the seafood from around our waters.
Which we do in great quantity. Do you have a favourite thing? I mean, it's a feast of a special food. So you're headed to the sea. What will you pluck from its depths, Richard?
I am the big fan of the Australian Sydney rock oyster. It is perhaps the best food we produce because it's reflective of the environment in which it grows, and particularly down the south coast of New South Wales and between Marimbula and Bermagui, a bit further north as well, they've got that beautiful forest, that spotted gum forest, and that still, thankfully, is a lot of it still intact, even though there's a lot of logging goes on there, and that protects the waterways, which protects the estuaries, which allows the oysters to grow big, fat and strong and delicious and available all the time except after heavy rains.
I guess the added benefit of that is that that's just got you out of the kitchen, hasn't it? You...
Oh, okay. All right. I'm not a big fan. Like, you know, farm, weatherboard house, growing up that way, big hot St. George's oven in the corner, heating the whole house up. I swore as a kid I did not want to go through those hot, infernal... eternal Christmas days where it got so hot you could not stand to be inside. I am therefore a big fan of the seafood Christmas.
You got your Sydney rock oysters. Yeah. What else might you have on your platter?
Okay, we're going to pop them open. I might have a little bit of French-style Australian Sauvignon Blanc with them, perhaps a little Pinot Grigio. I'm not too sure. So we're going to have them, but I also think the prawn is really...
Prawn has a place at your table.
Oh, yes. It's really funny. We think of the prawns, you know, like Christmastime prawns, and those trawlers aren't out at sea on Christmas Eve bringing them down, you know, out. They're out, you know, all year round, but to not be frightened of the frozen prawn, because they're snap frozen on board the boats, or they're cooked and snap frozen, and they're sometimes the quality of them is a lot better than the raw prawn. Okay, so if you are looking for the raw prawn, make sure it's got a really strong body on it. It's not darkening just under the head, because that means it's beginning to oxidize and it may have been out of the water a little bit too long.
That doesn't sound particularly tempting at all.
But if you do get, if you are cooking raw prawns, you know, you throw them in some salted water and it's boiling away for a bit, you can actually tart up that water. You can pimp your boiling water by throwing in perhaps some Cajun spices, perhaps some smoked garlic or something like that to add to the flavour of them if you like. And you bring them out of the water. I don't chill them. I just let them sit for a little bit to cool down just a wee bit and then serve them straight away with a little bit of aioli. Delicious.
Having shucked our oysters and supped our prawns, I'm thinking we might turn now to a spot of salmon.
Okay, salmon. Now, I am a big fan of smoked fish, and salmon's getting a bad name for itself because of the way that that salmon's been farmed here in Australia and overseas, with the environmental impact, and the salmon industry looks like it's unstoppably growing in Tasmania. That said, there are still some good growers out there who have some sustainable techniques, and you can look them up online. But look for a really good salmon or ocean trout, and Gravlax is fantastic. They have smoked salmon, which is good, but sometimes a little bit too strong in the flavour. I really love Gravlax. Sugar, salt, perhaps some gin, some dill. And it just slices away. It's not, because it's had so much salt on it, a lot of the moisture has been taken out of the flesh and making it really, really firm. Sometimes salmon can be a little bit fatty and flabby, you know, look, which a lot of us become after this time of the year. But ocean trout that's been cured in the Gravlax manner is, to me, superior.
This is interesting. You talk about, looking up the sustainable fish suppliers, because we're so used to that now in sourcing our lamb from a farm that we know what goes on there, sourcing our pork from a place that we know how those animals have been raised and killed. Extending that out into seafood, that's a bit of a new frontier.
You have to look at the wild fisheries in Australia are some of the most regulated in the world. And our government controls that are put on the wild fisheries in Australia are really strict. And there are fishermen who have been fishing for generations. And I can tell you that their kids are reinvesting in fishing vessels, not because there's a huge profit in it, because they know there's a future in it for them. And so that's the true test for me of a sustainable fishery. And because of that, you don't see a lot of that third-party endorsement like MSC in Australia, because we've got such a really strong government control over our quotas, how much we can pull out of the sea, and what we do with it.
All right, you've had your way. You've talked prawns, and you've talked oysters, and you've talked fish. I want momentarily to talk turkey.
I can talk turkey.
I'm sure you can. And it's taken a few years for the conversation at this time of year consumes Americans for months, which is to brine or not to brine. Mm-hmm. Do you have a position on that?
I have a very strong position on turkey. In fact, there's a show called The West Wing by Aaron Sorkin on HBO. Yes. And one of the episodes, President Jeb Bartlett gets on the Butterball Turkey Hotline and actually calls up to work out exactly how long he should cook his turkey for and to what temperature, and whether he should cook his oyster stuffing, using raw oysters, inside or outside the bird. 3.5 minutes devoted to talking, in prime television, one of the most expensive political dramas ever made, devoted to talking about turkey.
And your position?
Brian. Look, turkey, as much as I love the turkey growers of Australia, it's a big bird and it needs all the help it gets.
It's a tricky beast.
Tricky beast, because those extremities like the drum and the thigh are so far away from the interior of the breast, they cook a lot faster. And so giving it a good brine, which is basically soaking it in a solution of sugar and water to which spices have been added, generally for 24 hours. Through osmosis, the muscles will actually pull in the moisture from that solution, plumping the bird up, giving you a lot more moisture inside the bird. And so as it cooks, it doesn't lose as much liquid, but what it does lose, and here's the downside to brining, what it does lose becomes too salty to use for making a gravy.
What about a dry brine?
A dry brine, you can give them a dry brine, but I don't, that's more of a rub.
Yes.
It's a brine or a rub we're talking here now. That flavours the outside of the bird and actually draws moisture out of the bird itself.
Defeating perhaps the purpose.
Exactly, yeah. So you can give your turkey a dry rub for as much as you like, but I think the wet brine is going to give you the best result for Christmas Day.
See, I mean, it is one of the great conversations in food, I think. It's seasonal and robust, that whole brining debate. But
I reckon, I reckon turkey's great, but, I reckon do two chooks instead of a turkey.
What about a goose?
Goose is a traditional Northern European Christmas bird. They are a migratory bird, and they fatten up in over autumn, and then they get all that fat reserves under their skin, lots and lots of fat around under the skin.
Or as they call it, carry-on.
Carry-on. Thank you. Thank you. And then they take to the skies and they fly south for the winter. And so when the goose is cooked, it's cooked full of all that beautiful fat, and that makes it so delicious. But that's a northern hemisphere. Geese do not do that here. Unless you buy a goose that is slaughtered and frozen in winter, you won't get that layer of fat.
As opposed to the Sydney rock oyster, which is year round lean.
They begin to. I was speaking to someone. This week has been raining in that part of the world, so we might be seeing it touch and go coming up to Christmas.
Because they get a bit muddy in
the. What happens is the water flowing into the estuary flushes out nutrients, and if there's anywhere near civilization, there's always a chance of pathogens to hit the water and then be taken in by the filter feeder. And so the government bodies will close down those oyster beds for say a week. Until the tests come back clear, because you don't want another
bit of poo in your oyster can spoil your Christmas.
Poo in your oyster can spoil your Christmas. Exactly.
Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you. And on that beautiful note.
Richard Cornish, he's a food writer.
This time of the year, there should be a hotline you can call with questions about cooking turkeys, a special 800 number where the phones are staffed by experts.
There is.
What do you mean?
The Butterball hotline.
Butterball has a hotline?
Yeah. It's an 800 number. The phones are staffed by experts.
Are you kidding me?
No.
God, I'm sorry. I love my country. Charlie, get me the number for the Butterball hotline.
Yes, sir.
Katie Wilkinson is Acting Northern Operations Manager at Air Services Australia, the Santa Tracker. Katie, welcome.
Thank you very much for that, Jonathan.
At what point do we expect Santa to enter Australian airspace?
Oh, well, unfortunately, Jonathan, that's actually a little bit of a secret. We need to ensure that nobody actually knows where Santa is at any given point in time, if you know what I mean.
But once that happens, we can track those movements?
We absolutely can. So anybody that is interested, which of course many people are, head over to santa.airservicesaustralia.com, and there's a whole lot of information on there where you can actually track Santa.
I imagine this is quite a sophisticated logistic operation, because I'm guessing that commercial and other operations would need to be cleared from the path of Santa and sleigh.
Absolutely. So actually, Santa still relies on celestial navigation. So we need to ensure that we are using all of our technologies that are available to us to give him the most optimal flight path possible. So we've got actually improved flight path flexibility with some of our fantastic technologies. And our air traffic controllers make sure that we can get him around in one night.
That must be pretty important, keeping those airways clear. Does he operate on a particular radio frequency?
He actually does. He operates on Reindeer 1, I think, is actually his call sign. I'll have to check on that one.
Important to keep that clear too, I guess.
Absolutely. That's dedicated to him. So as soon as he leaves the North Pole, he's dedicated on that frequency, and we ensure that there's no interruptions at all for him along the way.
And, of course, as they say, this vehicle may be constantly stopping. He's up and down a lot, and that must create some complications for air services.
Oh, absolutely. But we do plan for this pretty much year round. We're ensuring that we've got everything planned. We have got Santa's route already set up, so we have a pretty good idea of where he's going to be. But as you mentioned, he's going to be stopping and starting along the way. We're not entirely sure even how frequently as yet, because he's still finishing off his naughty and nice list. So we're actually not entirely sure how many kitties he's actually going to drop in on.
Well, that must be a flexible quantity. And I'm guessing, this is a government operation here, that the normal landing fees and so forth will be waived in his case.
For Santa's case, absolutely.
Oh, that would be a tremendous saving. Look, Katie, it's going to be a huge night. Let's hope that nothing untoward happens and it's, plain sailing for Santa.
Absolutely. We will make sure that it's absolutely plain sailing for Santa.
Katie, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jonathan. Merry Christmas.
And to you, Katie. Katie Thanks. Wilkinson from Air Services Australia. The real Santa Claus is at the mall, Lemony Snicket. Karen Hernandez is a senior product manager in paper and art reproductions at the Museum of Modern Art, New York. Karen, this is a busy time because MoMA, for many people, means holiday cards.
That's true. MoMA has a very long history of creating cards for the public. It is rooted in the fiber of MoMA, and we've been producing holiday cards since the 1940s, not too long after the museum opened its doors in 1929.
That must have been a bit of a breakthrough thought for somebody at MoMA. In 1940s, they will do Christmas cards.
I think we owe the credit to Monroe Wheeler, who was the director of publications back in the 1940s. We have a set of papers, the Monroe Wheeler papers at MoMA, that actually have enlightened myself and my contemporaries on the history of Monroe and how significant he was at the museum. He was a real mover and shaker. He was a real charismatic guy. And he had a love for Christmas. He loved Christmas personally, and he brought that love to the museum. He made friends with artists that he was working with at the museum, but also working artists that he met in his personal life. And he started inviting them to submit holiday card designs that were produced by the Department of Publications. And he continued that program and made it a more official process in the 50s, where he opened up the program to an open call system where he invited emerging and young designers to submit designs to be considered for inclusion in the assortment. To this day, the system works very similarly. We put out an open call early in the year, and anybody can submit a design to MoMA. That's the great thing. You don't have to be a well-known name or in MoMA's collection. And really, that was the spirit of the program that Monroe brought to us. And we try to continue it to this day. So we review hundreds of designs, just as Monroe and his committee did 70 years ago. And we narrow them down to a selection of about 20. Most of the designers, no one has ever heard of. And in line with the history of the program, some of these designers go on to be household names.
That open call is an amazing thing. And you must, as you say, there must be hundreds of people keen to have their work on a MoMA card. And the judging process must be a very exacting one.
We review hundreds of designs, and I do think there's definitely a desire to associate oneself with the MoMA brand and identity, but I think there's also an awareness that some of the most important artists of our time at one time contributed to this rich program. So Robert Indiana, you know, designed his famous Love screen print as a card for the MoMA program in 1965. It wasn't the first time he had worked on Love. He had been exploring that, but it was really the first time it was brought to the public. Other, you know, major artists such as Alexander Calder, Andy Warhol have contributed to the card program. So there's a very rich history there. And I think emerging designers and artists understand that, and they respect the line, and they want to be a part of it. So we receive hundreds of submissions from all over the world, and sometimes, you know, over 400 submissions, and we have to narrow it down to a line of about 20.
This season stand out to what has taken your fancy in the offering for 2018?
There's a wide range. In the 70s, we started producing interactive cards, cards that were more three-dimensional and really were viewed more as objects and keepsakes rather than a flat greeting card. And to this day, we work with a lot of paper engineers from all over the world, including Australia, actually. We work with an illustrator, Flora Waycott, who's in the line. She currently lives and works in Australia, and she's fabulous. Her card is doing wonderful. We're trying to bring the card back to some of its fine arts roots, and we worked with living artists Yoshitomo Nara, Kaz, and Cindy Sherman this year to produce some really wonderful artists' holiday cards that have been doing really well, and people are really surprised, and it adds an element of whimsy and surprise when you receive that card from the sender. We also just have some wonderful, more traditional, three-dimensional pop-up cards.
What a treat to find in the post a MoMA Christmas card. Karen, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Karen Hernandez. It was the night before Christmas, and there by the tree, a man with a microphone. Who could it be? Colin Bissett.
The Christmas tree is the perfect icon of celebration with its twinkling lights and glittering decorations. It's a curious idea too, bringing a living tree into the home for such a short spell. The idea of a decorated fir tree can be traced back to the Middle Ages in Northern Europe, when displays of greenery in the home symbolised the hope that winter might not be so bleak after all. Fruit and nuts were used as decoration to enhance the prospect of there being enough food to last the season. Mistletoe was thought to cure infertility, hence the tradition of kissing under a sprig. Only holly had a truly religious connotation, the red berries representing the drops of blood shed by Christ while wearing the crown of thorns, more suitable for Easter than Christmas, perhaps. Gradually, the other traditions lost their overt pagan quality and were incorporated into a general celebration of a religious Christmas. The idea really took popular hold in 1848, when the British royal couple, Victoria and Albert, showcased their lavishly decorated fir tree in a black and white drawing in the Illustrated London News. Being German, Albert was simply bringing into his home the German tradition, but it sparked a craze that has never abated. Glassblowers in 16th century Lauscher in Germany started the fad for delicate multicoloured baubles that could be hung on the tree, representing everything from fruit and nuts to forest animals and toy soldiers. The finest are still made there. And in 17th century Nuremberg, thin strips of silver were hammered into estincelle, an old French word that meant sparkle and which became our word tinsel. And finally, when the White House in America added strings of electric lights to their tree in 1895, the craze for illuminated trees and the idea of flashing lights was born. The history of the Christmas tree is more seasonal than religious, but the fir tree is also used in a more year-round celebration. It's another northern tradition, this time started by the Vikings, where a fir tree is tied to the top of a building to celebrate the raising of its highest part during construction. Attaching the tree was believed to appease the gods and bring good luck to the project, and bags of grain were sometimes added to feed the gods' horses. The ritual, called topping out, is now usually accompanied by a celebratory drink and has long been used by builders around the world. Unlike the Christmas tree, though, which is as often found made from plastic or tinsel, trees used for topping out ceremonies are always natural. Regardless of that, though, the sight of a tree, whether atop a building or sparkling away in the home or town centre, remains one of the most charming of the old pagan traditions still found in modern times. Celebration with a dash of mythology.
A lovely thing about Christmas is that it's compulsory, like a thunderstorm, and we all go through it together. Garrison Keillor. You've been listening to The Last Half Hour. This week, Christmas. And you heard from Richard Cornish, food writer, Kate Wilkinson, Air Service Australia Santa tracker, Karen Hernandez, senior product manager, paper and art reproductions at the Museum of Modern Art, New York, and Colin Bissett. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production, Chrissy Miltiadu. And a big thanks to you, our lovely Blueprint for Living listeners. That's it for us. For 2018, we'll be back on Australia Day next year, January 26, but fear not, the Blueprint Summer Series will be with you from next week. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holiday. Have a great time. I'm Jonathan Green.